fellow girls, boys, and everyone in between. I'm Scarlett.
I'm Roxy.
And I'm Marjorie.
And we are the Red Resistance Podcast. And here we are again, part four of our character arc discussion.
Welcome back, podcast buddies. Mm. So we've cracked open another bottle because of reasons.
Why not?
Reason. You don't need a reason for Riesling, though.
No. Oh,
that was,
see what you did there.
Really, really cheesy. So this is Debts and Lessons. So this is from Monterey County in California. This is an off-dry Riesling. And I've waxed poetic about Riesling to you guys before, so I'm going to spare you my diatribe on that. But I just want to read the back label. Wine crafted through debts of gratitude and lessons learned. And some of the characters that we're going to be discussing certainly have some debts of gratitude, and there are loads of lessons to be learned from all of these characters, even though they are a bit minor. But really, I just picked this because it's fucking delish. Baby cheers. So we left off with Luke. Where do we want to go from here?
You want to jump to the antithesis, Nick?
Let's talk about Nick for a bit. We did not get as much of Nick as we were hoping.
I'm so surprised. They just shipped his ass off to Chicago and called it a season.
Yep. Yeah.
And so I'm sure he's going to make an appearance again in season four. I don't see why they wouldn't.
No, especially from what I've read, a lot of his scenes were cut.
Oh.
Yeah.
Really?
So there was more to his story, and there just wasn't enough time. So I think it started with a interview from the actor that plays Nick. What's his name? Do you know?
I don't recall.
Max Minghella.
Minghella, yes.
Oh, that is a good name.
So he had an interview earlier in the season where I guess he said he was alluding to a lot of things that were going to happen for his character and where he thought his character was going to go. And it turns out those scenes got cut. So that's been confirmed, I believe, by Bruce Miller, that there just wasn't enough time to fit everything in that they wanted to with Nick this season, because they had so many other places they were trying to go with the season. So it really, I mean, his, any kind of character arc that he had this season really just kind of fell off the map. And I think that's kind of the theme with who we have left. And I think that's what it is. It just came down to there's just not enough time. And like we said, season three was so great in terms of what they did tie up. So there isn't really anything that I would omit to make more room for Nick or any of the other characters necessarily, in terms of where season three went. But I do think there's a, especially with Nick and like Emily, which are the two major ones that we have left, their plot lines just really fell off halfway through the season, and we just never picked it up again. That was it.
Which is frustrating, because if you're going to be editing an entire season and you know that you're not going to have enough time to follow through with these plot points and this character and these character developments, then why give us so much of them in the first five to six episodes?
Yeah, I don't know if they, I mean, I guess I just don't know fully how it works in terms of filming an entire television season, but I think they have so many arcs that they want to fulfill, and then it just comes down to they have to cut stuff out. And Scarlett, who does our editing, can attest to it, that sometimes stuff just has to go. And I think that they made the right choice in what they did. I mean, you know, the character arcs that we've talked about, the main ones, the Waterfords, June, Lawrence, it all just kind of needed to see a full arc. So we've discussed all the full arcs, and I think now what we have left is the minor arcs, although we haven't talked about Eleanor yet either. I don't know if you had anything to say about her, but her arc is fulfilled, so.
Yeah, that's a good point. We did gloss right over her. We meant to, but we discussed her purely in reference to Lawrence.
Right.
At the end of the day, I loved Eleanor as a character, but ultimately, she just proved to be a plot device to show that Lawrence was capable of human emotion and to be an embodiment of the mental health issues that are at hand in Gilead.
Right.
She didn't really have any, like, actual development.
Correct. I mean, we were filled in more on her backstory with the medication.
Right.
And the pre-Gilead life, and we saw some stuff with Lawrence, but you're right.
Yeah, I mean, even in episode two, when she's planting the rose garden over the Martha's body, she does exactly what she does in every scene that we see with her. Like, she has these moments of clarity where she's with it and is trying to, like, help with the resistance, but then dips her right back into her insanity.
And I think that may have been used to juxtapose June, who in hindsight, we realized was doing a lot of the same things where, right. I mean, June was on the edge mm-hmm. of losing it. So the entire season, but she had plenty of moments of clarity where she was like, okay, it was the same thing as Eleanor where she needed mm-hmm. a goal. She needed something to do. Right. And as long as she had that motivation and that she could pursue that without getting lost in everything mm-hmm. else, it was kind of the best thing for her. And I think June was the same way. When June had a plan, when June had something to work for each day, mm-hmm. she was a lot more focused, a lot more grounded in reality.
Mm-hmm. And Eleanor was not able to be as grounded in reality because mm-hmm. she didn't have a goal. She didn't have anything that she was working towards. Right. And also her isolation. And to quote yeah. that doctor, the brain atrophies and isolation breeds atrophy or something isolation. Like yeah. Something to the effect of like isolation causes atrophy of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good point. But yeah, so as much as I'd love to continue discussing Eleanor and her importance and significance as a character, I think we've gone down the mental health rabbit hole yeah. for quite a bit of time. And I think we should go back to Nick.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, for the scenes that they did cut out for Nick, mm-hmm. obviously we're never going to know what they are. So, they gave us a big breadcrumb about Nick and his place in things.
See, I don't know if I felt like that wasn't, and especially in hindsight, not so much a breadcrumb. Like, I feel like we already knew that about Nick. June didn't necessarily know about it, but we saw Nick's backstory. We knew that Nick came into Gilead and under, I don't know what that guy's name was, that got killed in the suicide bombing at the Handmaid above Glenn.
Man, I can't remember his name and it's bothering me.
Yeah.
Because I did know it once and I just can't
but
remember
I think
it right now.
There were already breadcrumbs that his position was a little nefarious.
Mm-hmm.
And my biggest thing with Nick, so the two things that I take away from Nick, I'm not convinced, as much as we really are impressed with how much the show has this kind of grand picture of where they're going season to season, I'm not convinced that they really know exactly what Nick's deal is. Because that's my biggest issue with Nick, because I'm not sure what his deal is, and I'm not sure the show's telling us very well if they do have an idea. Like, there's, as much as, like, we talked about Lawrence and all the mysteriousness shrouded within him in this season and how they wanted him to seem a little bit untrustworthy, a little nefarious.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, I mean, there's just so much about Nick that's never explained. With the season, like, I will never get over the fact that he got shot and then they just brushed over the entire, like, I don't know, he got shot and taken in by these guardians while June's in labor at this summer house of the Mackenzies and left alone. And then she gives birth and the Waterfords come get her, or, you know, someone comes and gets her and she's back at the Waterfords. And we just jump time and there's never an explanation for it. And that was definitely in the book. That was a big question mark of what is Nick's deal? Is he an eye? What are the eye's deals? Like, I just don't understand if he was a double agent, which is what it seems like he was. I just don't understand exactly what his role is in terms of eye versus driver versus, you know, now commander. I don't think the show knows what his deal is.
I have gathered that if you are an eye, I don't think that people necessarily know that you are an eye.
Okay.
So, yeah, he could be a driver, but he can also be an eye, because mm-hmm. I would think that the whole purpose of being an eye is that you're operating covertly so you can observe things.
To report mm-hmm. to the government, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So now would you say that he's also, so he's a driver and he's an eye and he's also working for Mayday?
I don't think he's necessarily working for Mayday. I think the only reason that he went along with what Mayday was up to was because it benefited his own child and because it benefited June.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know that he knew about Mayday.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing where it's like it was kind of alluded to. Him and Beth have some mm-hmm. kind of history.
Yeah.
And so whether it's purely just a personal relationship
mm-hmm.
or it was a grander thing, there was something between him and Beth.
Yes, definitely.
And then June came into the picture and he was still working that Mayday Martha network through mm-hmm. Beth
yeah.
for June. And he was certainly more motivated to get June out because of his child
mm-hmm.
and his, I mean, I think he genuinely cares about June and just wanted to get her out.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she was pregnant with his kid was like the catalyst of him doing that. But I feel like they were alluding to more of that. Like he had some kind of underground network understanding mm-hmm. with Beth. But I still don't fully understand what that was or how it ties into him being an eye versus being a driver versus being like unsympathetic to Gilead or anti-Gilead.
I mean, what I get from like what we know from Nick in the past, you know, especially regarding to how he fell in with the Sons of Jacob mm-hmm. and stuff, is that he was just kind of a wayward person who didn't have a lot of job prospects. I mean, that place that he was in way back when, and I can't remember when exactly this was, but it was when he met with the Sons of Jacob and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was like a temp agency or something. Right, so it sounded like he just didn't have like a solid direction. Mm-hmm. He got taken in by the Sons of Jacob. And that's what we're missing from that point where we realize that like, okay, so now he was working with the Sons of Jacob.
Right, from conception.
Yeah, from mm-hmm. conception. To, okay, now he's an eye in the Waterford's house. And we don't know what happens in between there.
Yeah.
And then you have, I believe it was Serena, who was saying that, you know, he was instrumental to our success in Gilead.
Yeah, that was
or something. That was something that
she
came later.
She said he was instrumental to the success of the crusade.
Okay.
So military is my guess. Mm-hmm.
The crusade would be for Gilead.
Right.
That's what the crusades imply.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. No, but I think it was just in a military aspect. Like he was just a soldier in the crusades mm-hmm. and was a military hero and was now given this position as driver mm-hmm. because he was otherwise unknown and didn't really need, I don't know.
So do you think it's a matter of him being like an unintentional national pride symbol where he is just was an indoctrined soldier for the Sons of Jacob and happened to do a number of acts that were advantageous to
had like military successes, like he proved himself in the military field like,
and happened to be on the winning side.
I'm assuming the crusade, and this could be totally wrong, my assumption is the crusade is the bombing of the three branches of the government. Or at least the two, or however many they bombed and that we saw.
I view the crusade as whatever it took to basically take over the United States in the name of Gilead.
And that would be that act, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I'm sure that
would be one thing. Maybe mm-hmm. he was the person that helped plant the bombs to take out Congress. Yeah,
right. Probably possible.
But it doesn't, none of that adds up to like
how he ends up being a driver?
Or how he ends up not, like whatever driver's happened with the Swiss, where they're like, I just feel
he's
like there's more to
source,
of it, to it. Almost like the way I feel like they were setting that up potentially was that he was going, that it wasn't so much that they were like, oh, we can't talk to him. We don't want any information from him. We can't trust him. It was more of like, to me, it felt like maybe they were already working with him, that he already had things he was doing and coming out in a public way.
Mm-hmm.
was going to mess up the fact that he was already this double agent. And I have no idea if that's accurate. I just want to think good things of Nick. But it just seemed to me like it was, I mean, look at Fred. They have no problem working mm-hmm. with Fred, but they don't want to work with Nick. Like, what exactly could Nick possibly have done that would have been so terrible that they're happy to talk to Fred, but they couldn't talk to Nick?
That's a valid point.
Mm.
I like that hypothesis. Based off of the notion that they're willing to take information from Fred, knowing that he was one of the commanders, but they're not willing to have any sort of negotiation or discussion with Nick.
It just seemed weird to me the way they were like, the way they shut it down.
Right.
And I forget the exact verbiage, but basically that he was mm-hmm. unreliable or not trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it was almost like they already know about him and they already know he's doing something. So he's just very mysterious. We just don't know a lot about what
the fuck
Nick's doing.
Yeah, we know nothing. It's like we went through two whole entire seasons mm-hmm. without having backstory on Aunt Lydia.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Nick, while they've given us little breadcrumbs, we've got like no backstory on him.
Oh, yeah.
But what I can't get away from is somehow, regardless how the hell he got there, is that all of a sudden he is in this position of power where he can walk through a gauntlet and people are saluting him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, and that's weird.
Absolutely.
One of the things that he did specifically mention as far as the cut scenes, was he was shooting machine guns. So I think they were intending to show us more of Chicago and more of his role as a commander. And that's what got cut out. So I don't know necessarily how. I think it just never really served the entire arc of the season.
Yeah, which stands to reason because we already have this expanded worldview where we're removing ourselves from what was, for the first two seasons, 90% in the Waterfords household.
Yeah.
So we have this expanded worldview of Boston / Gilead, and you're extending it into Washington, into the former Washington, D.C., and into the Capitol, expanding it into Chicago as well when you already have so many unanswered questions.
Right.
I can understand that as an editing choice.
Yeah, because I felt like they were kind of pushing Chicago down our throat a little bit down this in season one of, like, alluding to it and alluding to it and alluding to it, and then it just, again, didn't really come to fruition within the season arc.
Right.
So I think it might have been the general Chicago storyline that fell off that had to end up on the editing floor. But one of the things that I definitely realized with Nick is that I realized with the lack of Nick this season, what a presence, why I like Nick so much. And it's just because of what he does for June and the presence that he creates for June in terms of her own sanity. And I think with, like, talking about how much her mental illness has fallen off, her mental health has fallen off the rails, Nick was her, like, lifeline to humanity within Gilead. And not having that connection, that human touch, that human connection, I believe it. I don't know if you guys are on the same page. I feel like they really did have some kind of connection within their circumstances. And June talks about it a lot in season one and season two of, like, when she first starts sleeping with him at her own will, like, that was such a relief to see her have some agency over her own body and to find pleasure in another human being and find pleasure in sex the way she couldn't otherwise in Gilead. Like, it just wasn't meant to be a pleasurable thing. And so to give her that agency and to give her some sense of pleasure was really nice to see. And with the lack of Nick, you see the lack of June and Nick. And that's what I missed, was her being able to have someone to touch. I mean, she talks about it when she talks about Luke and how she's like, look, I got to do what I got to do here and you should do the same, and gives Luke that sense of closure in terms of moving on, at least, and finding happiness in his own life.
And she also talks about how no one dies from lack of sex. They die from lack of love.
Yeah.
And
lack of touch, is that what she said? Lack of love?
Lack of love, yeah. And she even admits that she and Nick were, I mean, like, she has love for Nick, whether or not it was reciprocated. I mean, he never actually says the words.
Yeah, but I think his actions showed it. I mean, he wanted her out. He was mad when she came back. He wanted to just get her out, period.
Right, but, I mean, even if he doesn't have a romantic love for her, he still has love for her as a human being and as the mother of his child. And that's a really good point, that once you remove him from her periphery, she does kind of start to go off the rails.
Yeah.
And whether they're mutually exclusive or not, I mean, it's an interesting correlation.
Like, she does love him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she said it in, like, the final episode of season two. And they have a moment. She does love him. So now he's just pretty much taken out of the equation for her. And that's going to leave a big hole, because now she doesn't have Holly Nicole. She doesn't have Nick.
She doesn't have Luke.
Yeah, she doesn't have Luke. So
she doesn't have Hannah.
This is the first time in a long time that she's been wholly on her own. So I can see what purpose Nick did serve her, and I'm sure that didn't do her mental health any favors either.
Right.
Absolutely.
So that's my biggest thing with Nick. I just want more information on what exactly his deal is, and I'm sure they're going to flesh it out further, because I don't think they intentionally meant to cut his arc so abruptly.
Right.
So we'll see more of it, but I think that's pretty much all I got on Nick.
I hope that's the case. I think onto another character whose arc was completely severed. Emily.
Oh, Emily.
Yeah, that was some serious severing.
Yeah, that was kind of annoying.
Especially considering in season two, she was an instrumental character to a lot of a lot of what happened.
Right.
She was the one that was that escorted Nicole up to Canada, where there was such a focus on her in the first, like, four episodes. Yeah. And then just where the fuck did she go?
Such a focus on her relationship with Sylvia, her relationship with her son. Like, there was so much there. And I'm like, wow, they're going to really take this through the season. And it just fell off.
Right.
And I think it was the same reason. I think it, as much as I want to see more from Emily, and I really wish they had fleshed that out more and showed us more of her struggle, I don't know what I would pick to cut instead of that storyline in terms of the season as a whole. Mm-hmm. Like, I get the dilemma.
The dinner scene between Fred and Serena. It's the only scene that comes to mind that we could possibly cut.
Mm. Oh, I like that scene, though.
I do, too, but, I mean, I can't.
I don't know. What, yeah, what purpose did it serve? Because, I mean, it's one of a few where we would sit there and look at Serena and be like, oh, man, she's totally fallen back under Fred's spell.
Just
like,
doting on him.
And the opposite. I'm like, did we really need it?
No, I thought that scene was the first time we kind of saw a little bit of reservation in her eyes of, like, Fred reminiscing and her being kind of like,
but. Well, initially, though, when we first watched it, we were kind of like, oh, wow. I think we had said that she was
desperate,
kind of like, you know, maybe like falling back into it. Like, she was contemplating, like, you know, like she was being drawn back in.
Right.
And so on a second watch, I'm kind of like, oh, yeah, that's the other time that she was looking at him like, oh, I have to go shoot this puppy now.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so can't cut that scene then, especially when it comes directly before the ballroom scene. Yeah, I can't think of anything that they could have cut. But for what it's worth, they could have added an extra, like, couple of minutes here and there.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the episodes, their runtime was under an hour.
Right. And that's where I just don't know where the logistics of, like, television showrunners versus, like, Hulu conglomerate of is what you're getting.
Or it could be something as simple as Emmy nominations.
Yeah.
Where you have to be below a certain minute mark to be qualified as a TV show versus a short film.
Right.
Oh. I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
I don't know the specifics of it either, but it would make sense.
Yeah. I think their episodes are still, in general, a little bit shorter than that time frame.
Yeah.
Just based on other shows that have been nominated for Emmys, it is a little bit shorter. And some of the third to final season episode was real short. Remember, we were like, wow, that ended more abruptly than we were expected, and it was only 45 minutes.
Right.
I mean, I guess they could have, like, really cut down on the June close-up faces. Overall, I think we got that point hammered home a little bit.
Yeah,
that was enough time to flesh out a little more Emily, but maybe not satisfactorily.
Good point.
Maybe with Emily, the point that they were trying to get at is that in these situations where you have families that have gone through this horrific separation, that the reunification is not necessarily what you would think it would be.
Right.
I mean, when you think about people being in this situation, you think they're going to, like, just run into each other's arms and, you know, there's going to be tears and happiness and, there's going to be all of that. And that's not necessarily how it goes. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of PTSD to hash out. There's a lot of survivor's guilt. Mm-hmm. It lasts through generations.
Yeah, of course.
I did a little bit of reading up on this today in regards to family separations and, you know, reunification after, and like what it does to you psychologically. And, you know, case in point, we're basically witnessing it on our national stage right now with the separations of families at the borders. And when, say, for example, you have these children that are separated from their parents and then all of a sudden they are reunified with them, it doesn't go how they think it's going to.
Right,
often the kids are, you know, sometimes they're so young that they may not even necessarily remember the people that they're being returned to. Sometimes they have a lot of anger because they felt like they were abandoned.
Right.
Then you have the parent who, like, who has a full understanding of everything that has happened, yet they go to their child and their kid doesn't necessarily want them. And how that must be a complete mind fuck, because all you've wanted to do is to get your hands on this kid, and now you have it, and here they are, they're like fighting you.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same thing with Holocaust victims. Even those, these were very few and far between, but if they were reunited with their families after, the way that it was handled really depended on, or the way the families actually turned out depended on how the
survivors' mental health was dealt with right out of the gate. And for the families where things weren't talked about and where things were like kept hush hush and like, you know, just let's just not talk about this terrible thing that happened in our lives, things didn't turn out well for them at all. But for the families that had like open communication, even if it was just say, for example, like one parent that had open communication where maybe the other parent was shut down, if that one parent had open communication with the child, then things might be okay. Things might be okay for them because it was like that one parent provided just that two-way communication that was needed to figure out what is this weirdness and sorrow that haunts our family.
Yeah.
So I think, if anything, Emily's character arc or lack thereof just gave us a front row seat to, even when these people are returned to each other, things don't go necessarily how you think they're going to. And we do get to watch this play out on our national stage, but it's the reality of things. Not everything is like the fairy tale of reunification.
Right.
It's very seldom that simple.
Right.
And even if it is right out of the gates, it doesn't necessarily go well after either. There's a lot of baggage to work through.
Yep.
And I think that they did at least shine a light on that. Emily's got baggage for days, for fucking days. I'm sure that we're going to come back to her at some point.
Right.
But I think that they did touch upon like the weird and awkward and uncomfortable of, well, now we're all back together.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And now what?
Which they did, definitely did, because you have that that moment where then when they're in Oliver's bedroom and he's drawn all of these pictures of his mom Emily as
superhero.
A superhero
mom.
Love
which is fantastic.
That was a great scene to rewatch.
It was so nice.
Yes. Yeah.
And at first there was this awkwardness. No one's touching each other. No one's like even brushing against each other. There's no hugs, no hand holding, and it's very awkward and tense. And then by the end of the scene, they've kind of relaxed into it a little bit more and started to realize that they are a family and that they can at least relax their shoulders and slump them a little bit around each other.
Yeah.
So I do like that they kind of dipped their toe into that.
Yeah.
But another point to make to that is that maybe we don't deserve to see that portion of Emily when she's healing with Sylvia, because so much of Emily's life was exposed. She was a handmaid. She had her genitalia removed. She has been run through some fucking shit. And it's all been on, for all intents and purposes, public display.
Yeah.
Right.
So maybe they're affording her chance to do her healing with Sylvia and with Oliver.
In private.
Yeah, but I like your thought.
It doesn't make for compelling
TV. TV show? We should fucking see it.
I agree with you on a TV show.
But in theory, I agree with it.
Maybe give us like little snippets of it here and there.
Right.
But
or don't give us the snippets in the beginning and then never follow through with how they're turning out.
Exactly.
We did also get to see that reunification with June, though, and Hannah, which was the same thing of, it doesn't always go as well as you think it's going to go. And that reunification that she'd been waiting for two seasons, when she finally gets it, it kind of sends her into the mental health spiral that we saw of holding on to that guilt that Hannah said, why didn't you try harder?
Maybe Canada was just supposed to be that counterpoint, kind of like June is a counterpoint to Serena and vice versa. Maybe Canada was supposed to be a counterpoint to how Gilead would handle these things. Or, I mean, the friggin' United States, how they would, you know, handle these things. Because when Emily goes up there, remember, she has that doctor's visit and you know, they are all concerned about, like, making sure that she's stable and, like, here, we're going to fix things downstairs for you. And, watch that cholesterol, which was, like, so random and weird. You know, but she is obviously going through some sort of therapy for what she's been through.
Right.
And then you have her seeing Oliver again.
Yeah.
And Oliver says, I'm not supposed to hug you until you're ready.
Right. Like, he's already been
coached. Been schooled on it.
Yes.
So it sounds like in Canada, they have already been well-versed on
how exactly to handle these people escaping Gilead. Mm-hmm. And they kind of have to be handled with kid gloves.
Yeah.
And I could see where rushing up to a person that's been through what Emily has with an unexpected touch could completely just... She might not react how you think she's going to.
Correct.
I think they have some pretty good insight into what these women in Gilead have gone through. And she's gone through an awful lot of abuse. So I almost feel like Canada is that counterpoint to Gilead of, you know, here we have this country that has, not that they don't have an inkling about it, but they obviously don't care. They don't give any credence to it. We have this country over here, which is Gilead, that doesn't give a shit about your feelings and how things make you feel and what this is, what this experience is doing to you, going up to Canada and being like, well, you have clearly been through a traumatic time and we're going to help you get through this and this is how we're going to do it. It's almost like there's this awareness versus no awareness.
Yeah, that's perfect.
So maybe that is what the purpose of Emily was. She didn't really have a character arc. She was definitely more of a plot device. But it did
within
give us...
Within this season.
Yeah, within this season.
Within the season.
You know, but it gave... I think it gives us insight into, like, just the different experiences and really just shines a light on, like, the just the fact that all these people returning from Gilead are going to have some serious PTSD. Everybody in this episode, or in this season, in this show, has PTSD. Literally everybody. How could you not?
Yeah.
And everyone is finally starting to come to grips with that, or starting to see that, starting to see it unravel them. Because after 5 years of this bullshit, how much more can you take? I like that idea of the Canada versus America juxtaposition as well.
Yeah.
Or Gilead.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I said America. Yeah, the, well, might as well be.
Formerly known as, the country formerly known as America.
The Canada-Gilead comparison. I like that. So what are you guys' thoughts on some of our other minor characters like Rita?
So we didn't see a huge character arc with Rita in this season specifically, but she's been a character that we've had since season one. And so we do know a little bit more about her. I'm really curious to see how she makes out in Canada. And going off of, like, what we've seen with Emily, what we've seen with Luke, what we've seen with Moira, Canada's becoming a bigger player within the show. More and more characters keep getting there. So half of our, well, I don't know if the Waterfords would consider themselves lucky, but.
Yeah, but nobody cares about what they think. I would move to Canada right now if I could.
No kidding. But they, I think Canada is going to be a bigger point moving forward. I think we're going to have to keep revisiting it because half of our characters are there.
Right.
So I love the implications of Rita being there, especially with Serena being locked up. One of the things that rubbed me the wrong way about Rita in the season was when she was kind of sympathizing with Serena and to June's face. Like, that hurt a lot to hear her talking like that. So I'm curious to see where they go with Rita. In terms of a character arc, I don't have a ton that they really fleshed out within season three, although I would like to see maybe some more backstory. We have gotten a little bit of backstory with Rita.
We just know that Rita had a son who died.
In the Crusade.
In the Crusade. And that's...
Or the war, which they weren't referring to it as the Crusade. So that makes
me think... they might be the same thing.
Yeah. I
don't know.
I think the Crusade, in my guess, the way I'm looking at it is the Crusade was the actual bombing of the Supreme Court and Congress. They didn't bomb the White House, as far as I can tell. Did they bomb all three? Whatever. They bombed... DC in general, major branches of government, and then enacted martial law. To me, that was the Crusade, and the war was everything that followed after it.
To me, the Crusade, I think they're one and the same, because have you ever heard anyone that's wearing a Martha's outfit or a Handmaid's outfit call it the Crusades?
No. Okay, I see what you're saying.
They call it the war.
Yeah, so it's just a euphemism.
Yeah, I think that everyone that's on the Gilead side of things calls it the calls it the Crusades.
Right. This Crusade implies a holy calling to make war on this for the greater good.
And for God.
I have no doubt that that's what Gilead would think they did.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. That I like that.
Yeah. And I'm inclined to agree with the frustrations with Rita sympathizing with Serena because she sympathizes to her face. She also, like, talks about, like, oh, Serena was always nice to me, and June retorts with, she's only nice when she wants something. But even prior to that, when they're in the capital slash DC,
Rita kind of snaps back at June a little bit as well about...
Yeah, that's the problem I had.
Yeah, about, like, Serena being willing to give up Nicole. So as much as I like to see the fact that Rita wasn't a mole and wasn't planted to take down this entire plot, the fact that she's in Canada now and puts her in that close of proximity to Serena means that she could hypothetically act as a character witness for Serena.
Right.
I totally agree. Mm-hmm. And and already we know that Rita kind of has some Stockholm Syndrome stuff going on.
Absolutely.
She's the poster child for it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, for her to be able to rationalize the things that Serena did. I mean, Serena full-on punched her in the face at one point.
Yeah. Right.
And she's still straight up like, well, she was nice to me. And I'm like, Rita, how quickly you forget.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
Like, were you concussed that badly by your wallop to the face?
Maybe Rita is still that wild card. Maybe she really is that wild card still.
Absolutely.
The one thing I can say in defense of Rita... I mean, when you put it into Stockholm Syndrome, it does take on a different light. Mm-hmm. But if her worst quality is, like, finding sympathy within other people, I mean, as far as the show goes, there are a whole lot worse people than Rita, who at least is just applying some sympathy and some understanding to Serena and her plight.
Absolutely.
Which is frustrating as a viewer, since we've seen all the things that Serena has done to Rita personally and specifically, but if that's just who she is as a person, to just be understanding and sympathetic, then
that's not how Stockholm Syndrome works, though.
No,
that's what, when you put that spin on it, I'm like, okay, that's a different thing than we're talking about, right?
Marjorie does make a good point there that the story is supposed to be told or seen through June's perspective, but Rita almost acts as, like, that, I don't want to say conscience or voice of moral reason, but, I mean, we've talked about this before. We've touched on it a few times where, like, if everyone was just a nicer person and lifted up their fellow woman, like, Rita understands that Serena made a hard decision by giving up Nicole, and she can sympathize with that. Mm-hmm. She sees that though she and Serena have this strange relationship, that Serena's at least always been kind to her when she wants something, forgetting the fact that she got walloped in the face, of course. But still, Rita makes a point to try to see the good in people.
Right.
So she acts a bit like that moral compass where sometimes the other characters have problems humanizing the other people. Mm. I think Rita worked really well, again, as a plot device to kind of help us to humanize Serena. I think she worked as a plot device to help us lift June out of that mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
I think she worked as a wonderful plot device to kind of help Luke keep his calm with everything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
She worked as a great plot device to help us see Emily as something more, because Emily, our last scene that we see with her is her acknowledging, like, saying hi to Rita and saying, Emily, of Glenn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And being able to say that without her voice breaking or crying or anything like that, but just, like, almost a little bit of acceptance on her end. Mm-hmm. So I think Rita helps us to see other people from a bit more positive, is not the right word for it, but, like, the sort of lens that we should try to see our...
Like a sympathetic lens.
Yeah, the sort of lens that we should try to see other people through, because, like, everyone's going through their strife and their trials and tribulations, and just because it doesn't adhere to your specific storyline or your specific wants and needs doesn't mean that they're not doing the best that they can.
Right.
I think it depends on whether or not she was a convincing plot device to do that.
True.
Because for me, I don't think she was.
Right.
Because... sometimes my problem with people that play the devil's advocate is that sometimes you're just wrong. Sometimes an asshole is just an asshole.
True.
And you can rationalize why they're an asshole all you want.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that person is just a terrible person.
Right.
And so I appreciate you going to bat for the terrible person. But at the same time, just don't bother. Don't waste my time like that.
Touche.
Yeah.
That's a solid point. And I don't think that Rita is 100% effective all of the time.
Yeah.
But I do think that she, you know, she came in handy sometimes. Like, her being sympathetic to Serena does make her problematic and makes her untrustworthy, which is why we thought that, like, she was a mole in the first place.
Right.
Maybe she still is. Maybe that's coming in season 4.
Oh, Jesus.
Poor Rita.
I know.
Poor
Rita. Sorry, Rita. Sorry. Look what I did again.
Man. I want to trust Rita because Rita, has Rita ever actively wronged anyone?
No, she hasn't.
I think she's our only character that we've seen that hasn't actively and consciously gone out of her way to, not to wrong someone, but to better her own circumstances despite and damn the cost.
Right. She's never seemed self-serving. Right.
Maybe she is just one of those rare, pure, empathetic souls that does good things and thinks good things and wants good things for people when they're good.
Mm-hmm. And wants good things and wants healing for people when they can be good but are also coming from a place of hurt.
Yeah. Damn. Maybe she's like the only pure person, aside from children,
right,
in this whole damn thing.
I would have to go back and watch season 1 and season 2. Yeah, I feel like she was a little bit, standoffish.
Yeah, she's kind of a snarky bitch to June for
June for a while she was, which I feel like is kind of the general protocol of Martha's with handmaids,
right,
from what I've gathered, from what we've seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But aside from that, yeah, I can't think of anything.
Hmm. Well, we can get more into that with season 1 and season
2. Yes, we will.
So then from Rita... Moira.
And Moira.
Not much plot development happening with Moira.
No. I mean, Moira stayed true to herself. She was angry and snarky and to the point. I saw her put Luke in his place.
Yeah.
I saw her tell off Serena, and that was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Help Emily adjust.
Like, yeah.
She's kind of just the steady rock of Canada.
Man, she's just great.
Right? she's just great.
Okay, so Moira's arc was Moira was just being great like she usually is. Moira is the ideal human.
Yep, it wasn't an arc. It was just staying true to her character throughout the season.
Yeah,
Moira, keep on keeping on, baby boo.
Yeah, I wish we had gotten more of her, too.
Yeah.
We need so much more Samara Wiley. I love her. I love her so much. She's a fantastic actress, and I love Moira's character as well. That's my only grievance, is more Moira.
Yeah.
Please.
Yep.
Yes.
But other than that, like you said, there wasn't an arc per se. It was just her being consistently true to herself.
Yeah.
Which is refreshing to see.
It is.
I wish we had more to say about you, Moira. But
stay tuned. Season 4.
We didn't get nearly enough of you.
No, exactly. But then from there, we've got one big gun left in the arsenal.
Yeah.
Mrs. Trunchbull.
Mrs. Trunchbull.
Oh, I mean Aunt Lydia.
Aunt Lydia.
Oh, boy, that lady is a trip. We got to see a lot of different facets of her throughout this particular season. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really fantastic because in previous seasons, she was just pretty much her standard... you know, she gives a little and she takes a lot. She gives a little and she takes a lot. Just very, like, steady authoritarian bullshit that she's just so good at.
Yeah. One-dimensional almost.
And I feel like that whole attack on her by Emily, which totally had coming. I mean, fantastic that that happened. If there was one person that had it coming, it was Aunt Lydia, and I don't feel bad about saying that one bit. But I feel like that whole thing that happened to her really served to try to get us to see her in a different light.
Okay.
And, you know, because, well, is it the second episode that she finally makes it into Larry's house and she's doing, like, the home check or whatever? And... she, you know, she falls up the stairs and June goes to check on her and she cattle prods June. I think that was the beginning of what I perceived as PTSD.
Right.
Which it goes to show you that if Aunt Lydia can be negatively affected by things that happen in Gilead, then absolutely everybody can.
Right.
Maybe that was our opening to this is all the way that Gilead will fuck with everybody from the top down. Right. No one is safe.
Even the people that subscribe to what they're saying.
Yeah. And we know that Aunt Lydia is 100% on board with this bullshit.
Of course.
Well, so, like 90%.
Yeah. Or, well, I give her 95. And she's 95% down
there
with this.
There are a few times that she's not down with the bullshit.
Yeah. I think she's 100% down with the ethos and their mentality.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe 90% their methodology.
Right. Yes. So. But I mean, she is that person that burns people's hands on, you know, oven grates. So I'm just kind of like, and, oh, I'm sorry. Did you get attacked?
Right. And burns their feet for running away and has girls get salvaged.
Yeah.
She's
definitely that character where, you can explain all of the issues that she has after that with her PTSD and, you know, her past that we saw briefly, you know, with her time as like a school teacher. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you still don't fucking like her.
Right.
Whereas with like Serena, I feel like, yeah, her character sucks, but you still like her.
Yeah.
Because she's so completely dynamic. Mm-hmm. Aunt Lydia, even after you learn all the stuff that she's gone through and, you know, just how she got to where she is, but we barely get any story on that because right. I want that missing piece.
Yeah.
How did you go from school teacher to, you know, the aunt? I still can't stand her.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that this is because if Aunt Lydia were Uncle Lyle.
Wow.
I did not think that through. But let's assume that we had this exact same story arc and the exact same backstory given to us from, instead of it being Aunt Lydia, a male.
Right.
And you would have this character who was trying to fight his own humanity and then put the moves on this lady that he was like genuinely interested in for who knows how long. Mm-hmm. And the lady was like, I really like you and I want to keep seeing you, but like this is moving fast for me. So can we just pump the brakes? And he goes off the deep end?
Right. He would be entirely unsympathetic.
Exactly. Mm. And I think that that's part of, like, subconsciously why you're fighting against any sort of empathy or sympathy with Aunt Lydia. Mm-hmm. Because if her gender were reversed, we wouldn't have even been having the discussion that we were about her. It would have just been like, you repugnant human being, how dare you?
But typical male.
Exactly.
Right.
But because it's... because this is Aunt Lydia and this is a woman, we can sympathize with her because we've all
want to humanize her a little bit more.
Right.
We do. And we also, I think because we're three women looking at this perspective of this woman who's a bit of a social outcast and was just trying to reclaim that little bit of herself. Like if this was a middle-aged guy doing that, we would be like, what the fuck is wrong with you, dude? Right. Like, you're smashing mirrors now and you're getting like people thrown into jails and getting kids ripped away. Like, you're a psychopath.
Right. Fuck your entitlement.
Right. And we still do think that to a point with Lydia, but we're also just like, no, this is a catalyst and this is like a turning point for her.
Yeah. So and I think it was embarrassing and it was hard for her. Like, that's a really compelling thought.
Yeah. So I think that has a lot to do with why seeing this backstory to Lydia, while it's enriching and gives us a bit more whole of a view of her as a character, it doesn't do much to make her more sympathetic necessarily.
It doesn't change who we thought she was to begin with.
Exactly.
I think it's just more of the same. It was really interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't wish that they dropped it. I just think that it's not this new light that we see Lydia in. It's very much the same light we've seen Lydia in.
Right. I would actually argue that slightly because, like, when she was jumping on top of Mr. Thorne, we were like, "You go, girl!" Like you're getting that, it.
Yeah. So we see her in new circumstances,
and we see
her old circumstances. I suppose they were,
but we see her owning a little bit of her sexuality, which
and then shutting it down.
Of course.
And, I mean, it didn't give us any like.
Any new groundbreaking information.
Right. It was other all like, than, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. Other than she's fighting against her own human nature at every turn.
Right.
And stifling herself.
But my biggest issue with Lydia's arc in this season was, I mean, I guess kind of the same as Nick and Emily and everyone else who didn't have enough time to get a full season arc in. It just fell aside. Mm-hmm. There was so much there in those first six episodes of where are they taking Lydia? Where are we going with this? And then you get the backstory and then she just kind of goes back into typical Aunt Lydia and we're back to June and getting those kids into Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So just more time is what I need with Lydia. I feel like we put a lot of thought into her rage and her definitely PTSD, but also we talked a lot about We talk a lot about her longevity in Gilead, and maybe she realized that there isn't much of a future, and she thought that her job was being threatened since the handmaid had attacked her. Like, there was all these implications of where it was going to go, and it just went nowhere.
She was painted in a bad light because she's the one that brought Emily back from the colonies.
Right.
And for Emily to turn around and do what she did, you know, she attacked Aunt Lydia, and then she, quote unquote, stole the baby and, like, left for Canada.
Right.
Aunt Lydia is very much painted in a terrible light. And so when you have that, and then she has this kind of like physical disability that she's recovering from because of the attack. And then she goes from that to the Putnam's party where she beats the ever-loving fuck out of Janine in front of everybody, which in that particular moment, I think that just served as a way for the upper echelons of Gilead to really see what it's like on the inside for their handmaids to get a full understanding. Because I feel like they're kind of, they have that degree of separation where they don't necessarily see bad things. Right. You know, they're not party to it and therefore everything's okay. But also they see her, she's out of control and she's in a weakened state.
Yeah.
And she has bad judgment.
Right.
And if you think about it, in that particular scene, everybody is in the room looking at her, judging her.
Yeah.
And because she does have those strikes against her and her character, what she believes, you know, her and her character. And then you've got, you know, cut to like, what, four episodes later in Unfit, where she kind of has the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think that she felt like, I feel like they did kind of bring it back around to this situation, which is intolerable to her, where her judgment and her like standing in the community is judged.
Right.
I don't think she can handle that. And that, to me, that just drives home that point that I had made, like, you know, a bajillion episodes ago about Aunt Lydia being a fucking narcissist.
Yeah.
And her being perceived as somehow less than what she thinks of herself is intolerable to her.
Right.
I also think, which is a fantastic point, and I love that. I also think that an undercurrent to that as well is that she is at least acknowledging the fact that she is in a patriarchal society and as an aging woman who just endured a physical attack and is, you know, not fully physically fit at this point, she needs to assert herself to be able to be seen as relevant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because these people do not, I mean, the patriarchal society that it is does not respect women with any sort of sense whatsoever. I mean, the aunts are the closest thing that we have to women that are respected. And even then, that's tenuous.
But only because they have a purpose.
Exactly.
The only thing that's valued in that society is to be young and fertile and nubile.
Or
that's it.
Or be useful. And if Lydia is not useful,
and then she's not young and she's not fertile and she's not nubile,
then she is not necessary in Gilead. And it might have been a fear mechanism kicking in at that point where she was like, needing to prove her relevance and needing to prove her strength to be able to continue to do her duty.
So this is the point where if you don't want any spoilers for the testament, you're going to turn us off because we have not read the book. We're a week away from the book coming out, but we've read a couple reviews from people who have read books, and you're going to want to turn this off if you don't want to know anything at all. We don't know much, but I'm going to talk about some of it. So if you don't want to hear spoilers about the testaments at all and you want to go in completely blind, then you're going to want to skip over this part here. But there has been a couple articles that have come out with reviews on the testaments, Margaret Atwood's sequel to The Handmaid's Tale. And what we know so far is that there are three storylines. There is one from a teenage girl in Canada who finds out that she was born in Gilead. There's one from a teenage girl in Gilead. And there's Aunt Lydia. And all I know from what I've read is that Aunt Lydia is a lot more sympathetic to the resistance cause and anti-Gilead than one would imagine.
Oh,
okay.
So, oh, my Lord. Oh, my Lord.
So hang tight.
That is super exciting. So I didn't know anything about the book.
Nothing.
Until you were telling me about it before we started recording because I was trying to go in as blind as possible because I love a good surprise. You asked if I was okay with spoilers. I was like, fuck it. We're a week out at this point anyway. It's not like I have to like sit here and marinate on these ideas. Hot damn, you didn't mention that part.
Sorry.
No. Don't be
surprised. You should have paused me.
Right. Oh, hashtag regrets. No regrets. No, that's so exciting to hear, though. Because
there's not much other than it's really one NPR article that I read. Mm-hmm. But there's more to Lydia than meets the eye, and we're going to get some more out of it. So
amazing.
I hope so. I mean, if they saw this going for, like, what they said, like, roughly 6-7 seasons.
Yeah. Right.
I would sure as hell hope we get more Aunt Lydia.
One would hope. Also, while it's fresh in our dear listeners' minds, considering that Sweet Marjorie just mentioned NPR, if you happen to be an NPR listener or not, fuck it. I don't give a shit if you are. You should be.
You can find it online.
Yes. Go look online. There are some fantastic interviews. There's a story linked on NPR, which is in our Red Resistance Speakeasy. One of our dear listeners who is part of the Speakeasy posted the link to that, so you can find the link to that in the Speakeasy. So come join us there. Mm-hmm. And also, Kurt Anderson is a podcaster or a radio host with NPR. He hosts Studio 360, and on August 29th, he had a full hour long about The Handmaid's Tale. So it talks about the testaments and what to look forward to with Margaret Atwood. So there's a conversation with Margaret Atwood talking about her inspiration for the books, as well as an interview with Anne Dowd, who portrays our beloved Aunt Lydia. Mm. So something worth checking out. So Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson, and it is the August 29th interview.
Yay! I didn't know about this until, like, a little earlier, so I'm, like, so pumped to go read this.
Wait. Yeah. You're so pumped?
I am. I'm pumped. Isn't that what you kids used to say? I'm pumped.
Yeah, there's been two chapters that have been released that I got to listen to Margaret Atwood read again, linked in the Speakeasy, because that's how I found it. And it's so good. The Lydia chapter is so interesting. It's only the first chapter of the book. I can't wait to get more.
I have to go check this out.
Oh, I'm like hardcore fangirling right now at the notion of this.
I'm dying. Yeah. This is going to be great. Yeah. Oh my God.
This is a good spot to plug our next week's episode too. So our next week's episode will be right on the heels of the book first coming out, like 24 hours later after the book comes out. So we are not going to be in any way, shape, or form ready to discuss the book necessarily.
No.
But the NPR article did talk about the fact that the men of Gilead are highly irrelevant. They're basically like the Chris Maloney's or the George Winslow's of Gilead, where they're basically exactly what you expect of them. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, they're not really existent within the story. And it's really those three characters, those three females.
Nice.
And a lot of the focus is on the fact that these women are doing this to other women. And next week, we are going to talk about women bringing other women down in the course of history. And we'll see where that conversation brings us to.
We're going to be talking about all of the Aunt Lydias and all of the Serena Joys of the world and all of the women who are complacent in their own dehumanization. So that's going to be loads of fun.
It'll be rich. I'm sure there's plenty we can pull from.
I cannot freaking wait. I am so excited about this.
Marjorie has this mischievous grin on her face. Like, she's just, like, sitting on a treasure trove of information. And Scarlett looks like someone just, like, put, like, dynamite in her brain.
I am on this, like, white on rice. It's like 3:00 in the morning, and I'm like, I'll go start researching right now.
Right?
I can think of 10 off the top of my damn head.
Oh, I mean, realistically, we could do an entire season of episodes of just spotlights on women that have been complacent in creating second-class societies for other women.
Not even complacent, but active.
Very true. Yeah, that's
a bad active.
So that's going to be a really fun episode for us to jump into. So I hope that you'll join us. And if there are any people that are just, or any abominations that would consider themselves human beings that you'd like to see us showcase, throw some ideas at us.
Oh, we'd love it.
Yeah, we'd love to hear what you have to say. With the amount of different women that we can go through, I mean, it's probably going to be quick snippets on every single one. But, you know, if you have one that's just like a glaring example that you just can't help but see all of the parallels, just throw it out there at us. We'd be interested to hear what you have to say. Yeah. We might not go into detail, but we'll give you a shout out. Are we done with Testament spoilers?
Yes.
All right, beautiful. If you were fast forwarding through the Testament spoilers, you can come back now. I have no idea how long it's been. I'm so sorry. Hindsight is 2020. So,
do you have anything more on Lydia? That's basically all I have.
I don't, because like I said, we had a good amount of her, and then we had her background reveal story, and then it was just back to business as usual with her.
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel like that whole background reveal story, while I liked it, it doesn't give you how she got to that point of being the type of person that would throw this woman who was just like less fortunate than she is under the bus.
Yeah.
Right.
It still doesn't give me a why. And that's what I like to know about these people is how did this person get to the point where they could be so terrible?
Mm-hmm.
I want to know that. That little snippet that happens pre-Gilead doesn't do it for me.
You want to know the impetus behind their actions.
Absolutely.
And I think we've been giving breadcrumbs to the impetus. The thing that jumps out for me with Lydia over and over again is that conversation she had with June towards the end of season two when she talks about her niece or nephew passing away.
Yeah, you had talked
to her. Oh, and she said it's not her fault. Yeah. It's not my fault. It's not my fault.
And so whatever happened to that child seems to be that she has decided to make it her life's mission to protect children at all costs. And I just don't know what it is that she feels so much, she's harboring so much guilt for.
Or was she actually responsible for the death of that child?
Right.
And then in typical narcissist fashion, because I will not get off this Aunt Lydia being a narcissist thing if you fucking paid me to right now. She's just like, no, I will not be held accountable for my actions.
Yeah.
So she could be at fault all day long for whatever it is that happens in that child,
well,
she will still not own it.
What if that some, I mean, this is total speculation at this point, but what if she, like, there are times when, as citizens, you should report unfit mothers.
Yeah.
And what if she didn't at that point, at a time that was entirely reasonable to protect the child?
Oh.
And now she has taken it upon herself to seek out any kind of child who may be in harm in any way.
Now she's hypervigilant.
Yeah.
A little bit of survivor's guilt there manifesting itself in the hypervigilance.
Wow. I like that.
I do too.
So we'll see.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see how much more detail we get about Aunt Lydia in this TV show, considering they're going to be jumping into more of our dear Aunt Lydia in the Testaments. So we know that we're going to get snippets of her, or we're going to get a good chunk of her story in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So how much are they going to give us for context in between the two?
Mm. Now, we do know that Bruce Miller is in talks with MGM to discuss how they're going to take the Testaments information and turn it onto the screen, whether it's within The Handmaid's Tale or within a spinoff series.
I'm so excited.
I cannot wait to get my hands on this book. I can't tell you.
This is amazing. This is going to make my whole September. I'm so pumped. I did it again. I didn't mean to do that.
I'm so pumped. What I'm hoping is that they start the Testaments as a TV show after the conclusion of whatever this Handmaid's Tale is.
I agree.
And that way you can continue with the same actors where appropriate. And that way, and also for those that are just TV watchers, they don't have to worry about spoilers. They can watch the natural progression of the plot. We don't have to worry about overlap.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about like, oh, Handmaid's Tale is on Wednesdays, but then the Testaments is on Sundays and this is on episode 4 and this is on episode 12 and everything gets all cattywampus and you're trying to keep track in your mind.
Yes.
So
also, I think if anything, they're going to run it into with the show, the same problem that Game of Thrones ran into in terms of actors wanting to move on.
Yeah, to
There's
do
only
something
so
different.
Much you can do for so many years. I mean, that was like a decade of their lives.
I feel like if they were to go into a TV series, though, I feel like that would be... They would go into the TV series, and then they would go to that place where failed TV shows go.
Yeah.
Because I feel like sequels to TV shows never do as well as you think they're going
to. I know. Even critically acclaimed ones.
Agreed.
Which is seen?
Like Breaking Bad. Like there
I was just
going to
say, that's exactly what I was thinking of. I know it's great, but I've never even watched it.
Can't be bothered. I watched the first two episodes, and I was like, I hate this.
I've never even watched a single episode.
Oh, really?
But I've heard it's fantastic.
I can't get
and
into
I
it.
And I love Breaking Bad, and I still not have any interest to revisit that.
So... Amendment to what I'm hoping that instead of making a new TV show tacked on after Handmaid's Tale, it's just a continuation of The Handmaid's Tale, and we have this time jump that happens.
Yeah.
So after they finish what they consider to be The Handmaid's Tale story, they jump to The Testaments, or perhaps because we're in like this weird... Like in between, we're in this like weird in between right now between the book The Handmaid's Tale and the book The Testaments.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're just going to extend the next two seasons to cover that like 15-year time frame and sort of give us a time warp into The Testaments, but maintaining it as The Handmaid's Tale, the TV show to kind of tie everything together nice and neat with a little bow.
Oh boy.
I would like that.
I'd like that, too.
Well, let's see what's in the Testaments first, and then we can...
Agreed. And that way you don't have to worry about, like, that Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul sort of stuff, or, like...
Friends and Joey is the one that just jumps out at me.
Ugh, don't get me started on Friends. It's so problematic. We just lost 50% of our listeners.
We didn't. We promise you we didn't.
I've only seen one episode of Friends.
Oh, thank God. I've only seen, like...
What?
I've only seen, like, five or six.
Wait a second. You can't have such a strong opinion
yes,
if you're wrong. You're right. I suppose you can.
Yes. What was the example that I was thinking of, though, about TV shows that are split or that are...
Well, the reason you can't remember is because no one ever remembers the sequel show.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Oh, Big Bang Theory and Young Sheldon.
Oh, right.
And that's like the most recent example.
I've never even heard of it.
Oh, I love Young Sheldon. It's actually, I really like it.
You're one of the only few
people. But I don't watch it religiously by any means.
I'm sure it's super cute and loads of fun.
Yeah.
But who watches it?
No, you're right.
Exactly.
I only watched it because it came on something else that was after, right over.
Yeah, spin-off shows don't do well. Yeah. Game of Thrones, listen to us. Spinoff shows don't do well.
Just don't bother.
Oh, don't even.
Bruce Miller, listen to us. Don't make it a spinoff show. Just make it a continuation of The Handmaid's Tale. Do a nice time warp. Tie everything up for The Handmaid's Tale like this in-between time in like three seasons and then boom, jump into The Testaments.
Call it The Handmaid's Tale, The Testaments, and move on.
Don't go 75,000 seasons like The Walking Dead has, where there's nothing but The Walking Dead.
Oh, I've never watched that show.
And don't go Game of Thrones where you make this incredibly deep, rich world and then you try to tie everything up in six episodes and it's garbage. I'm not, okay, saying it's garbage was a bit inflammatory of a statement, but where there's way too many loose ends that you can't tie up and there's no way to appease all the fan theories.
Yes.
No, you were right. It was garbage.
No, garbage. Oh my God, we need an episode on this.
All right, we're getting distracted though at this point. So, but yeah, so it'll be nice to see what they do with bringing the Testaments to the small screen.
Yeah.
But it'll also just be nice to get the book in our hands.
Yes.
And have some new tangible material.
So, talking about books, I wanted to do a little segment where we talk about what book nods we've seen from season three. Book nods for The Handmaid's Tale.
Mm-hmm.
So, we only have that one book to go off of.
Right.
But they've given us some little breadcrumbs. The major one, of course, is the cassette tapes.
Yes.
That was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
We also got butter for lotion, which is a big thing for Scarlett.
No, we didn't get butter for lotion.
We did.
How?
Cora. No, not Cora. What's her name? Beth.
When?
Beth talks about it. So after June, when June is punished for, what the fuck was she actually punished for?
When her feet were burned for trying to run away?
Was it from running away? Because she wasn't technically considered running away.
Oh,
she came back, but no one really knew about that.
I don't.
What was she punished for?
I don't actually remember, but I know this was not the first time that we've seen this punishment for her.
What the fuck was she?
It was after the Waterford's house burnt down. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that episode, you see Serena go in one direction. You see Fred go in another. And you say you see June get carried off in another. June went to the Red Center.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is just occurring to me. Why was she being punished exactly? What the fuck was her problem?
I don't know. Because they're trying to keep the fact that that baby left Gilead basically with Serena's permission under wraps.
Right, but would they know that? I mean, Fred tried to keep that all under wraps of the baby was just stolen.
Wow, why the fuck was June there? I don't remember that.
I don't remember either, and I bet you it's on the lost episode.
It totally made sense to me.
I don't think it is,
even
though.
On the rewatch, I watched it and was like, oh, it makes sense to me as to why she's being punished. What the fuck was she being punished for?
All three of us have watched that episode within the last 2 weeks and none of us can remember.
Fine, it's just a Riesling. There's definitely a point in the season where Beth acknowledges using butter as lotion. When June is picking at her calluses, I want to say it must be episode 2, the Martha episode, Martha and Mary episode.
Mary and Martha.
I'll have to go back and watch, but there's definitely a nod to it. And I'm surprised we never picked up on it because I know it's been such a thing for you, Scarlett.
Yeah, I don't remember that at all. I just remember, all I remember in regards to that is June talking about how the handmaids smell in the heroic episode when they're like all praying. And mm-hmm. I'm like, wait, they don't smell like butter? Right. Why don't they smell like butter, goddammit? And no, I don't remember that at all.
She mentions it because when I was rewatching it, I was like, oh, the mention. And it never occurred to me that we never realized it.
Oh, wow.
So I have to go back and watch what it is. But they definitely do mention it, which is ridiculous because it's definitely been such a thing that we've talked about. Then we have the Fred and June scene where she's grappling with how she feels about him as he, at the baptism, when he's standing, he takes a seat and he's alone. Serena's not there and he's got his little, like, black cords and he's definitely on the outskirts of these commanders and she's grappling with, it wasn't love that I felt for him, but it was something. And she's trying to figure out what it was. That's from the book. That line, a lot of those lines were pulled directly from the book. Mm-hmm. And then you have the one that we've brought up a lot in this episode, where Lawrence was talking about inventing a humanity for others, which I believe in the book June says. It's obviously not a Lawrence quote. So it was interesting that they gave it to Lawrence to use, but I think it was June talking about inventing a humanity for others in general when she's trying to invent a humanity for Fred. And she's she has a little bit of Stockholm syndrome with him. Mm-hmm. Where she does feel a little sympathetic towards him. Mm-hmm. But that's the only book nods that I have off the top of my head. The cassette tapes were huge.
So I don't have any of the notes, but the one that really did jump out with me was the cassette tapes, of course, because that was so heady.
So. Yeah, I'm wondering if they're going to do more with that.
I hope so.
It was really cool. It was fun to see. I really love that cassette tape nod in that whole episode was great with Eleanor and Lawrence and the mixtapes and Luke. Mm-hmm. I loved all of it.
I did too. And I mean, for what it's worth, we might end up getting some Easter eggs and breadcrumbs for the testaments in the upcoming seasons of Handmaid's Tale to kind of tie everything together too.
Oh, I cannot wait to get some new book material. This is so exciting for me.
So
then we have some hanging plot threads. There's a couple that I just really want more from. We've gotten some breadcrumbs and I was really hoping to see it come to fruition, but it didn't in season 3. Mm-hmm. So number one would be Cora. What the hell happened to her? I don't know if we're ever going to know.
We're never going to know. Nope.
At length off recording. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of allusion to what happened to Cora. And at the time when I was viewing it in the beginning of the season, I really thought we would see what happened to her in the end. And it would all kind of make sense as to what Lawrence's motives and implications were. But we don't know what happened to Cora, and I don't know if we're ever going to find out what happened to Cora.
I would be flabbergasted if we ever learn any more about Cora. I really would. I feel like it's just going to be one of those, she was carted off, never to be heard from again.
Then we have Mayday's other plan. That's a big one that they kept alluding to, especially as June was taking the reins with her plan. The Marthas were resisting her because they had a shipment coming in, and they didn't want June to mess that up.
What was in the shipment?
So I don't know.
Never find out.
Yes, it seemed like such a breadcrumb of we're going to find out what it is and it's all going to make sense and tie in together. And it didn't. So I don't know if we'll ever see it. But
I think that we might get some of that in season 4 because the Martha Network has been slowly but steadily becoming more prevalent throughout as the seasons progress. And
there is undoubtedly going to be some repercussions from everything that's happened with June getting her wild plan off the ground.
Yeah.
Including the tightening of the Martha network.
Yeah.
So I'd imagine that we will at the very least hear glimmers of like, oh, now that we don't have the planes coming in and out, we can't get X, Y, and Z. Right.
Now, it was my understanding that the plane that those children flew out on, mm-hmm. that shipment was the plane that was coming in prior.
Mm-hmm.
That was how I perceived it. I don't know if that's necessarily true.
Plane coming in full, leaving empty.
Right.
Which is why they were able to get the kids.
The empty plane that was delivering that shipment was going to be filled with the kids and they were going to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened. So what was the shipment that came in?
Right. That's what I'm saying. Is that we're eventually going, like in season four, they're going to go into that. And we're going to see what would have or what could have possibly been in that shipment and what they're no longer going to be able to get shipped in because that avenue is going to be closed down.
That's my biggest concern for season four is that there's going to be a lot more restrictions put on everyone and therefore the Martha network is going to be hindered.
Right. I think at the very least, I feel like they'll touch on that indirectly.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see. I just want to know what came in because we know that Martha was being shipped out, the chemistry Martha, right?
Right.
And they give the Breaking Bad reference.
Well, it was probably like Canadian whiskey. Because how else is...
oh, that is so Boardwalk Empire.
Well, how else is Lawrence getting his supplies of scotches and whiskeys?
Yeah, no kidding.
And you have to have some booze at Jezebel's.
Absolutely.
Just saying. So we also have the hanging plot line of what is Serena going to owe to June? Because June set up the phone call with Luke and afforded Serena the opportunity to go to Canada and be able to say her second goodbye to Nicole. And June demanded that that Serena owe her something. And when Serena said, what? She's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So what is that going to be? And when's she going to cash in on that?
Yeah. The only thing we can think of that she may have already cashed in on that was the bottle episode, Heroic, where she didn't rat her out.
The other thing that we thought about was, I mean, granted, this would certainly tie up A Handmaid's Tale as a series by season four. We had hypothesized that perhaps Serena is going to call for June's extradition to testify on her behalf.
Yep. Mm.
And June's negotiating piece and the big IOU is going to be, oh yeah, I'll totally come to Canada if my daughter can come too.
Yeah.
And we get to stay. Yep.
I'll totally come to Canada and I'll go to bat for you and be like, you're not the horrible person that I know you are.
Right.
Just so I can get up there with my daughter.
Exactly. Which would be.
I really hope that's it.
I hope so too.
Wait, that would make her just as self serving as Serena. She wants her damn kid and she'd fuck everyone else.
Whatever.
That's a valid point. Well, but for what it's worth, yes, we know that Serena went on this crazy book tour. She was instrumental in the creation of Gilead. Fred's going to go down for that shit. Either way.
You think so?
I hope so.
Good Lord, I hope so.
I hope so as well. I don't think that Serena's going to ever be fully exonerated of her crimes.
Yeah.
I think that she still will have to bear the repercussions, but I think that she might be afforded a less violent end or perhaps a bit more accommodating of, this is redundant, accommodations. While she's in her life internment, if she's willing to cooperate and if she has someone corroborating for her that, you know, yes, she did all of these things. However, you know, she also protected me and helped me get this child out of Canada and yada, yada, yada. So I can see that working.
The only issue I have with that would be that it veers from what the book says.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're veering from the book, then are we veering from the testaments?
That's a good point.
Because I'm waiting for Fred to go down in the purge. And he can't go down the purge if he's going down in Canada.
That's a good point.
Ooh, are we going to see the purge?
I
want
to see
in the
purge.
Next season. What That'll be it, cool.
What if it's a Lawrence propagated purge?
Oh, snap. That would be amazing.
That'd be cool.
Because Lawrence knows exactly who the pieces of shit are that he works with.
Mm-hmm. Right. That'd be quite
the plot twist. And if he is the closest thing that they have to a person in a position of all-encompassing power, he could orchestrate some shit.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The same way they orchestrated some shit with him.
Yes.
In the ceremony with June.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that would be loads of fun.
That would be more fun than watching Fred just kind of fall away to the justice system, which would be entirely just. But I would like to see Fred go down, like, really epically.
True. And the purge would be appropriate.
Yeah. Ooh. The only other plot twist or plot thread that I have, and it's not really one that they've promised a lot, but I've been waiting a lot for, is the Putnams. We've gotten, early in the season, we got Mrs. Putnam. Why can't I think of her name?
Naomi.
You have Naomi Putnam, who thanks June for saving her child. Mm-hmm. She just seems to be kind of throwing it out there that she's not entirely Gilead reformed. Mm-hmm. And we know that she kind of got her, not kind of, she fully got her husband's arm cut off in the process. And then you have Commander Putnam, who had that weird line with June, which was such a weird line. It was just this one-liner, and that was it, and it was a throwaway, and we didn't see anything come to fruition where he acknowledges her, which is more than most people do in that situation, especially in a room full of commanders where they're discussing commander things. To turn to June and say, well, you must be the only one that's happy with this, is to acknowledge that she has any kind of agency or existence
about anything.
Anyway,
capability of an opinion.
That was very interesting. Yeah. Well, I feel like Putnam, I mean, he did have this tryst with Janine for a pretty fucking long time.
Right.
So I think that Putnam, whether he wants to admit it or not, realizes that, wow, handmaids are real people with real feelings.
Right.
Whoa.
Crazy concept.
And therefore, it makes him seem like a reformer of Gilead, just based on that concept.
Maybe. And
so we'll see.
Naomi Putnam was down with going before the Horum and reading the Bible. Not necessarily the reading the Bible part at the end of season two, but everything that came before it.
Yeah.
I mean, she was there for it. And Serena was her... Naomi was the first person that Serena went to to be like, what do you think about this?
Yep. And she was on board, and therefore that gave Serena the confidence to take it further.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that we're going to see more from the Putnams.
And I hope
so. Dynamic than we've seen so far, which will be interesting.
That would be really cool. I would appreciate that.
Yeah, me too.
However, counterpoint to my own appreciation, we already have so many characters that they don't have time to fully explore and flesh out.
Right.
That as much as it would be really cool to see what the Putnams have to offer, it's probably best if they stay as periphery characters.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they already had to cut scenes of pretty instrumental characters just to make their timeline now.
Yeah. So this is my point where I plead for them to make these seasons longer and the episodes longer.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least the seasons.
Agreed.
Because they have a lot of material they can go off of. I don't know how it works, but they should make that happen.
I agree.
Then we got a lot of world building in the season.
I love that.
Me
I love that
too.
So much.
I eat it up anytime I get any kind of Gilead ceremony. So we got the Gilead baptism.
Yep.
And we got it juxtaposed. This was a big thing, too, that I kind of forgot about. So we talked a lot about how there wasn't many flashbacks. And the flashbacks, when we got them, especially in the last season, the last episode, really change the way you feel about the episode. When you can see how it was pre-Gilead and then you see it immediately post-Gilead, you kind of can relate to the characters a lot more. The Gilead baptism was one that I forgot about because it's juxtaposed with the baptism of Hannah, which was really cool. And I completely forgot that that was even a thing, that we did get more flashbacks than I remembered. We got the Gilead baptism. We got it juxtaposed with Hannah and June and Luke deciding to baptize Hannah, and then we got Nicole being baptized. But we got to see Gilead and their ceremonies again.
Mm-hmm.
We also got a Gilead funeral, which was, you know, interesting. It wasn't a whole lot.
It was
to
a little
away.
More forgiving than I thought it would be.
Yeah,
and there also didn't seem to be as much... Almost less pomp and circumstance than it was for, like, a handmaid funeral. Because remember when they had, like, the mass funeral for the handmaids?
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like it was...
Like they were mourning the loss of fertility in their society versus the loss of a human being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for a society that was manufactured specifically to harbinger fertility, losing any number of handmaids is a loss for the entire society.
Right.
Whereas the loss of a wife especially one that's not exactly of child rearing age or abilities, mm-hmm. is a personal loss, but not one so much for the society as a whole.
Right.
Yeah. But they definitely like mourned her more on a personal level, mm-hmm. for sure. And the fact that, like, you know, the handmaid's funerals, it was just based more on fertility. And because remember, they didn't even say their names.
Yeah.
No, yeah.
It was of Albert, of, mm-hmm. you know, Joey, of, like, whoever. Yeah, like, it was God. Always of right. somebody else. They didn't even use their real fucking names.
Right.
Why would they?
Exactly.
No reason to.
Nope.
Because they only exist as uteri.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as more world building, we got to see outside of Boston / Gilead.
Yes.
And not just
huge.
Canada. We got to see D.C.
Yeah. D.C. was horrific.
It was.
Don't way really more mess. Horrific than it is right now.
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't say way more horrific.
Oh, I mean, Rings and Mouse are already pretty horrific.
I don't know. Okay, the Rings valid. And Mouse and then the, Washington Monument being a giant cross.
Yeah,
that sure was alarming to
the
me.
The kneeling on the pillows. The... don't speak at all. I don't even know why you're talking to me to begin with. Handmade.
I don't know. Maybe this is the nihilist in me coming out. Surprise, surprise. But I don't feel like we're that. We're slowly slipping towards that.
Yeah, we're getting there.
With the stripping of rights of marginalized people every single goddamn fucking day.
I mean, 100%. Even Target is selling handmade pillows now. No, seriously. So I was in Target today. No, they're really not. But I was in Target today, right? And I just happened to turn into the pillow aisle. And they have this pillow on the shelf that is that long rectangle. I swear to God, about the same size.
Oh, no.
And it was friggin' red. It was more of like a cranberry red rather than like a handmaid's red.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still really fucking red. And the second I saw that pillow, and it was the only one on the shelf, I was like, are you kidding me right now? Wow.
Exit
I can't get away from this show.
I will say that as much as DC currently may be moving towards Gilead, I will take DC currently over Gilead currently any day of the week.
Okay. I agree with you.
Yeah.
But, with one exception, mm-hmm. at least with the ruler, with the leaders of Gilead, Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., they're consistent. You know what's going to come out of their mouths. They hold to their ridiculous and absurd agenda, but they are still, they hold true to it.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know what we're going to hear from 1 hour to the next from Agent Orange.
From Agent Orange, fine. Mm-hmm. I'll agree with that.
Who is the mouthpiece of our government, whether we like it or not.
But I feel like he's almost an ineffective mouthpiece, and the real snakes in the grass are going to be the Mike Pences, the Mitch McConnells.
Of course.
And they're a lot more discreet,
mm-hmm.
but also equally consistent in their ridiculousness.
I'm inclined to agree with you on that entirely, but I'm just saying from, like, that propaganda standpoint.
Yeah.
Like, it's a consistent message coming out of Gilead, D.C., whereas this D.C., I mean, yes, it's a consistent message, but it's also, like, slowly chipping away at our rights as opposed to, like, we've chipped away at your rights.
Your rights are gone now.
Yeah, now we're into status quo territory.
Like, right.
I think in regards to Pence, we could probably just expect him to follow through on the actual Handmaid's Tale fantasy, considering he probably 100%. Masturbates to it.
I mean,
1,000% he does.
He can't even be in a room with a woman without his wife being present because, I mean, God forbid he can't control himself. That I can't even finish that sentence to make it funny because, like, the notion of it made me want to vomit in my mouth. I would just like to see someone try to do conversion therapy on him. See how he likes it. Sure, it'll work out real well.
We talked about it a little bit before, but we got to see Commander Nick mm-hmm. and the Gilead military on the train, but we didn't see anything further, and we mm-hmm. talked about why we didn't see anything further, but I would like to see more of the Gilead military because it's been alluded to that it is so strong, which mm-hmm. makes sense that if they're taking over the United States military, it is the strongest military in the world, and therefore Gilead would now be in possession of the strongest military in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to see more of Chicago that they kept alluding to, and especially like just the world affairs in general, which, again, testament spoiler, but I've read that we do get more of the world mm-hmm. view on Gilead within the testament.
Cool.
So I would like to see more of that.
That'll be refreshing.
Yeah. And then we got the aunts, which was pretty mm-hmm. cool. The aunts assigning the handmaids was something mm-hmm. we hadn't seen, and we kind of, there was a lot of mystery involved in how the handmaids got assigned. So to see that mm-hmm. the aunt sitting there drinking their whatever the fuck they were drinking and
with the cognac,
their little like
they're assigned by a lazy Susan.
A lazy Susan.
So like, can you just picture it? One night the aunts just get kind of sauced. And they're just like, spinning. Yeah, fuck it. You know what? We're just going to spin it. And wherever she lands, that's who she goes
spin
with.
Spin the bottle kind of.
Could you just imagine? I can.
Yes.
Wow.
Entirely. What made that a slightly more petrifying scene, though, is that we see that there's more aunts than just Lydia, which means that there's more women other than Lydia that prescribe to this absurd mentality. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to know how deep that network goes yeah. and how many aunts we really have. Or is it just these right. three controlling this one little neighborhood? Is right. it those three controlling?
There's got to be more.
There has to be more. I mean, at the very least, we know there's more in D.C.
Right.
But I'd like to know, like, what's happening with other aunt-controlled areas mm-hmm. in Gilead.
Yeah.
Like, just bring our focus out slightly more. Also, I want explosions. I've been asking for them so nicely all season. And I know that we're probably getting, like, off-camera explosions after all these kids made their exodus, but I just yeah. want to see something blow up.
I know. Well, that was my whole thing with, like, the shipment that the Marthas were waiting for, on top of the fact that they sent that chemist through the Martha network to wherever she was going, and June helped her get out, and whatever's happening, I feel like it's bigger than the world we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to see more of what's happening. If I could complain about anything from the season, it's going to be the mouth rings. It felt more like a shock and awe tactic than any kind of reasonable thing that Gilead would actually do, because it just doesn't make sense.
Well, it's just weird because it doesn't really seem to carry over to anywhere else. Like, it doesn't make it up to Boston, really.
Yeah,
like, they
mentioned it.
Well, I remember in the grocery store scene where, what's her name? I think it was Alma mentions mm-hmm. the veils.
Yeah.
Like, because that's what she called them. So just because they have that thing mm-hmm. over right. their mouths, does that necessarily mean mm-hmm. that they have the rings?
No, I don't think so.
They mentioned it, though, when they are, so they were in Fishes, Loaves and Fishes, mm-hmm. and got called to
yeah.
the conference, and Winslow was walking around asking why, or like
yes.
when the rings were going to get implemented, and mm-hmm. Lydia talked about how it was going to be, you know, held of the highest esteem, and
yeah.
But it would be voluntary.
Right.
Of course,
and that's all we got. Like yeah. that was it. I'm just,
but that's a pretty heavy implication that it's coming to Boston.
But it just doesn't make any sense. There's nothing about that makes any sense.
Well, that's the problem that I have with it, because it almost sounds like it's voluntary. So they're like giving their handmaids a choice. When do they give the handmaids a choice about fucking anything?
They never right. do.
Like, basically never. So it doesn't make sense. If they wanted to implement something,
mm-hmm.
that's it. They're going to implement it.
Right,
so
right.
to me, that tells me that the people who were in charge of that sector of Gilead at the time, which would be Fred and company,
mm-hmm.
I don't get the feeling that they were 100% down with it, because right. if they were, it would have happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Especially Fred with his ambitions about, you know, just trying to crawl up Winslow's ass and be the good boy so he gets good things that come
right.
to him.
True.
I get the feeling that even maybe for Fred, that wasn't going to fly for him. And then it doesn't matter anymore because he's not there. But
just in basic, like, life needs, the handmaids are a resource. If nothing mm-hmm. else, they're mm-hmm. considered a resource. Clamping their mouth shut with rings doesn't help anything that they're trying to do with these handmaids, in terms of they're the fertile ones mm-hmm. who are bearing the children. Mm-hmm. Then they should be able to eat
mm-hmm. and brush
just
their
that
teeth.
Simple. Like, yeah. It doesn't make sense mm-hmm. in terms of Gilead, especially since Margaret Atwood had gone to great lengths to make sure that everything that she put in The Handmaid's Tale was something that happened in history.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I could tell, these handmaids' mouth rings haven't happened in history, mm-hmm. at least in the mm-hmm. context that the show is using it in. And it just really felt like they were trying to shock the audience, which, I mean, mission achieved. We were all shocked
yes,
and terrified.
Right.
And it was, but it felt more like a ploy than any kind of logic based anything.
It might have also been because seasons 1 and 2, there were accusations of it being shock porn
yep.
and torture porn.
And with season three, we didn't have as much of that. I mean, we didn't have to actively witness them whipping the bottom of June's feet and everything else that went along with that. So I think they wanted to throw something that was going to be viscerally jarring in that we might not have expected.
Yeah.
And you could see it once, twice, if you count the time that Aunt Lydia adjusted the veil.
Right.
And then from there, all you need to do is see the veil and know that the threat of it lingers.
Right.
And the threat of it is more ominous or as ominous as seeing the actual. So I think that that was sort of the purpose of that, is to remind you that these horrors are still here.
Yeah.
They don't have to show us all of the horrors that we've already seen.
Right.
But let's just, like, remind the audience just exactly where you are and how much worse things are in the capital than they are in Gilead.
Right. And I think that was all achieved. I just wish it made more sense in terms of the handmaids and their fertility and the fact that it just doesn't make any sense.
It'd be nice if you could, like, I mean, I know that this sort of is counter to the whole point of them, but detach them so they can brush their teeth and eat.
If it's something you can take out at night, take out meals, then I suppose fine. But
those look welded on.
Yeah.
Plus them banging up against your teeth, that's going to cause teeth damage.
Which is the least of their problems, I suppose.
Well, I mean,
lead to infection and stuff like that, and then that's a big problem.
Right.
Well, what they might do, because, I mean, it's not like these women are going to be able to brush their teeth with these rings in, is just pull their teeth. Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Well,
liquid diet.
This is going down a really bad rabbit hole. We got to get off this train.
Yeah.
Enough.
Putnam will be all into that.
I'm pulling the lever on that conversation, though. As far as complaints, I don't have any other than if mental illness was going to be our key story that ran throughout this series or this season, it would have been nice if they made it a little bit more clear so we didn't have to, like, go back and, like, rewatch it and be like, oh, now we're picking up on all these clues.
Yeah.
It makes for really wonderful storytelling in a movie where you can go back and watch it over 2 hours. But when we're talking 14 hours of content,
that's
a lot to go through.
Mm-hmm.
That is my biggest gripe right there.
I mean, I know that we said, like Larry, you know, said at the beginning, like, are you insane? Okay, that's great. But that could just be, you know, hyperbole. That's just a figure speech.
A normal human response
Yes, a completely normal human response. That does not tell me the whole season is going to be about June and how she's walking a fine line between reality and insanity.
Right. Exactly. So that's my biggest gripe right there, is that I enjoy how subtle they are and, like, how delicate a hand they take with some things, but this was a little too delicate of a hand.
Yeah.
Because we were hyper-analyzing this show and we started to pick up on it, but we picked up on it, like, 6 episodes too late.
Yeah.
So if you've made it this far, podcast buddies, we appreciate the hell out of you. We've gone off on a couple of tangents, but at least they've all still been centered around what's been happening in the Handmaid's Tale universe and not going off on some weird diatribe about our personal lives, because we edited all that out.
True story. Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. So next week, we will be recording the day after the release of The Testaments. So, again, to echo what Marjorie said, we're not going to be going through the testaments or reviewing because, I mean, not everyone's going to have time to even get the book, let alone read even the first chapter of it. Mm-hmm. So we want to give everyone time before we get into that.
Yes.
Instead, we are going to be talking about the Aunt Lydias and the Serena Joys of the world and the women who are complacent and active in participation in their own dehumanization and the dehumanization of other women. So we hope that you'll join us. We're really looking forward to this conversation because it's going to be loads of fun.
Can't wait.
So in the meantime, thank you so much for listening. And do all of the rating and subscribing things that we always talk about. But you'll hear that in our outro. So until then, bye, guys.
Love us, hate us, either way, let us know. We welcome feedback from intels and incels alike. Let us know at theredresistancepodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And don't worry, no matter what you say, we won't let you bastards grind us down. Praise be to Peter Levesque at Heliovox for providing us with the badass instrumental tracks we use for our intro-outro music. You can find Peter on SoundCloud under Heliovox. That's Heliavox. Finally, we're under his eye, but never under his thumb, so we'll see you back here next time.